Buddhist Summer School, Tuesday afternoon, 6th September 1983. Venerable Sirs and fellow students, Your Reverence, your sense organs are quite pure, your complexion very bright, very clear. On account of whom have you, Your Reverence, gone forth? Or who is your teacher? Or whose Dhamma do you profess? In those words did Upaka, the naked ascetic, address the Lord going to the high road between Gaya and the tree of awakening. In the Mahasiddhana Sutta, Sihanada Sutta, the Buddha describes in detail to Sariputta the extreme ascetic practices he went through before the enlightenment. One of these consisted in restricting the amount of food he ate each day, and he told Sariputta, "While I was subsisting on one single jujube fruit, my body became extremely emaciated. All my limbs became like knotted joints of withered creepers. My buttocks like bullock's hooves. My backbone like a string of balls. My gaunt ribs like the crazy rafters of a tumble-down shed. The pupils of my eyes appeared lying low and deep in their sockets like sparkles of water in a deep well," etc., etc. It is a somewhat harrowing description. And he goes on, "But by this course of mortification, I did not reach states of further men or the excellent knowledge and insight befitting Aryans." Siddhartha Gautama gave up these practices. Just as well, for a dead ascetic is rather less capable than a live Buddha for showing the way to liberation and enlightenment. So one day he fainted and fell down. And he decided that it was time he took some nourishment again. After several days, on the day that he was going to be enlightened, he was brought a meal by a lady, Sujata, who was the daughter of the headman of the village, of the nearby village. And that meal was a remarkable sort of meal, not merely refreshing, but inspiring, apparently. You should read the full account in the texts. Later on, after regaining health and strength, Gautama realized enlightenment, found the deathless, and on the road to Kasi met Upaka, who made those remarks which I read out right in the beginning. Gautama's constitution must have undergone an extraordinary transformation between the day when he nearly died and the day of the Sammasambodhi to have elicited Upaka's complimentary remarks on his appearance. Sariputta and Moggallana were originally disciples of Sanjaya Velathiputta. They agreed between themselves, "Whoever attains the deathless first, let him announce it." One day, Sariputta saw Assaji, one of the original five bhikkhus, walking for alms food in Rajagaha. At an opportune moment, Sariputta approached him and exchanged courteous and friendly greetings and addressed him with the same words with which Upaka addressed the Buddha. Asaji, out of modesty, gives Sariputta only an epitome of the Dhamma. Those Dhamma which proceed from a cause, of these the truth finder hath told the cause, and that which is their stopping. The great recluse has such a doctrine. I think I ought to explain. Dhamma is the whole teaching. Dhamma is translated in so many different ways. One translation is things, and the texts usually in English print things. Dhamma also means, I think, states of mind. If I'm incorrect, please correct me. And I think it is more useful to regard Dhamma as states of mind, because what did the Buddha heal? He healed the mind. He was a doctor of the mind, perhaps the greatest psychotherapist that the world ever has seen. So I prefer to regard it this way. Those states of mind which proceed from a cause, of these the truth finder has told the cause, and that which is their stopping. That means how you free yourself from all your difficult mental states and conditions. And that is really the supreme dukkha, after all. Supposing there was no mind and only a body, there'd be no dukkha. And also vice versa. No mind, no dukkha, no dukkha, no mind, no body, no body, no mind. They are always interlinked together. Thereupon there arose in Sariputta Dhamma vision, dustless, stainless. Whatever is of the nature to uprise is of the nature to stop. And he said, if this is indeed Dhamma, you have penetrated as far as the sorrowless path, unseen, neglected for ages. When Moggallana saw Sariputta returning to him, he said, friend, your faculties are quite pure, your complexion very bright, very clear. Can it be that you have attained the deathless? Yes, friend, I have attained the deathless. Sariputta then recounted the meeting with Asaji, and Moggallana said, let us go to the Lord, for the Lord is the teacher for us. This attainment of the deathless is not an attainment by the mortal existential being, as an existential being only. By living the holy life, the brahmacharya, the whole psychophysical organism is purified. The person ceases to be self-conscious as a separate subject. He is no longer isolated from, but is in union with the totality. That is, his sensitivity is so perfect, so complete, that whatsoever the environment may be, he is in right relationship with it. Note that he is in right relationship with it straight away. Discriminative consciousness, vijnana, has faded out, but is not destroyed, because the existential life needs the operation, the activity of vijnana, discriminative consciousness. Otherwise you'd run over a bus if you saw it coming to you. I mean the bus. So vijnana is not destroyed. It has been transformed into cosmic consciousness. Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabham. I suppose I shall repeat this phrase all my life, because it is so important. Which now functions freely through that man, the erstwhile Putujjana, the ordinary mortal, who is now the Uttarapurisho, the winner of the deathless. The cosmic consciousness has supervened. quite naturally. It just, I think supervenes is the best word. You don't gain it, you don't win it, it doesn't overwhelm you. It just floods you like that, very gently. The dichotomies between body and mind, between self and not self, between the finite and infinite, the temporal and the eternal are no more. The unitary wholeness, the stainless holiness, light and life, karuna and prajna prevail universally, unhindered, at ease, the divine ease, which is the bliss, the ananda, which is inseparable from Nibbana. Perhaps now we can understand, even in small measure, the significance of the words, your reverence, your sense organs are quite pure, your complexion very bright, very clear. Transfiguration of the body is one of the signs of holiness, of perfect humanness. You all know about the transfiguration of Jesus and how his disciples were affected by that experience. Now this transfiguration is occurs with the other great teachers. Zarathustra was transfigured. Any of the other teachers, Lao Tzu underwent transfiguration and so on. It is said of all of them. Moses was transfigured, you know that. And when he came down from the mount, his face shone. That is the statement in Exodus, is it? Or? Yes, it must be in Exodus or Genesis, I thought. Exodus. Anyhow. So it is one of the signs of holiness, of perfect humanness, because holiness is perfect humanness. The word human literally means happy or blissful creator. That is the real meaning of the word human. And that is the term the theistic religions apply to God, the blissful creator. The winning of the deathless is not a bodily fact. What I mean by that is, we all know that Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, died. He suffered illnesses also after the enlightenment. He died. All the teachers died. All the great spiritual teachers died physically. So the winning of the deathless is not a bodily fact. The deathless is the eternal, and eternity, unhappily mistaken as everlasting time, is awareness in which time is entirely absent. One can't explain this. You have to experience it actually, and then you'll know what it is to be clearly conscious, to use the Buddha's own terms, clearly conscious. And it's a consciousness in which the awareness of time is completely absent. Time is the movement, the disturbance of vijnana functioning in us, discriminative consciousness. Our attention flits from this to that, to that, to that. That is what causes time. But there is also... is entirely absent. Time and death, and hence sorrow and fear and anxiety, are inextricably interwoven with existentiality, with dependence, and hence with bondage to all the fluctuations, insecurities, and absence of freedom of discriminative consciousness. But with the transmutation of the world-bound existentiality imprisoned consciousness into the pure or absolute consciousness, by living the holy life, the supreme spiritual freedom of the full-fledged human is realized. This is the meaning of the deathless. You may notice in the Chula and the Maha Saropama Suttas, the two suttas, the Buddha at the end of the discourse declares unequivocally unconditioned freedom of mind, unshakable freedom of mind is the goal of the Brahma faring. The context of the existential is the finite, temporal and mortal, ruled by the Lord of Death, Mara, whose body is dukkha, constantly sucking your lifeblood. The context of the deathless is the infinite, eternal, immortal, ruled by the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, the uncompounded, the nameless unknown. But the Lord of Death is the inseparable twin of the Lord of Life. The wholly awakened Buddha, in his own words, utterly enlightened with an unsurpassed enlightenment, transcends the rule and dominion of the inseparable twins. His awakened consciousness is the actuality, and his existential being until its death is the living embodiment of the timeless communion of the nameless unknown with all the world, through him, the star of truth, the heart of love. It must not be thought that the change of consciousness is a sudden, once-for-all change, and thereafter remains confined to the transcendent context. In fact, there is only one context, the one total reality. In order that I, as an ordinary human being, may talk at all, it is impossible for me to talk, excepting in terms of the duality, this and that. That has to come in, otherwise I can't communicate. That's not only my fault, it's the fault of all languages in the world. There are no words, no sort of symbolical sounds which can express the transcendent. Also, we must bear in mind that the infinite, eternal, wholly subsumes and completely interpenetrates the finite and mortal context. Not the other way about. The finite and mortal context cannot hold the infinite eternal, but the infinite eternal functions through it when it ceases to offer any hindrance. So it is like this: your bathtub cannot contain the ocean, can it? But the ocean can contain your bathtub. That is the difference between the two. Again, it is not a case of the mortal context being here and the immortal being beyond. It is a bit like this: pure consciousness is creative energy functioning in the special way which we experience as knowledge, insight, enlightenment. Every energy needs an apparatus to manifest itself. I, the existential mortal, am the apparatus. In my undeveloped state, the young one, consciousness functions in a simple way, the child's knowledge, finite and temporal. When I develop in the right way and become fitter and fitter to receive a more powerful charge of consciousness, I have more insights, not mere intuitions, but true insights, unerring insights into truth, into the Dhamma. And there is more intense functioning expressive of the infinite eternal. In fulfillment, the Kata Karaniyam, of the Buddha's teaching, done what there was to be done. In that sort of fulfillment, there is full realization of transcendence, a clear, shining consciousness of the infinite eternal. Put it another way. Suppose I start as if I were a bulb, a light bulb, made by nature with the possibility of taking voltages, say, up to 1,000,000. At a lower voltage, I will give out very little light. As the voltage increases, my light becomes increasingly intense, a brilliant searchlight afterwards, till in culmination it illuminates the whole world. It is this kind of thing which happens in profounder and profounder contemplative states, the jhanas and samapattis. The intensity of the consciousness becomes greater. It is not like climbing the rungs of a ladder. That's a hopelessly materialistic way of looking at it, and hopelessly inadequate way. Till at the transmutation point, the infinite eternal supervenes, and the mortal existential, having liberated transcendence, moves on peacefully, including the pain of dying, if bodily ill, to its final and permanent rest. This, perhaps, is the transcendental meaning of requiescat in pace, rest in peace. Be grateful then to the Lord of Death, the compassionate giver of blissful eternity, beyond all possibility of understanding by the human brain. If and when the sense of transcendence stirs, and there is an awakening of consciousness into the context of the infinite and eternal, extraordinary transformations take place. Consider for a moment one of the outstanding differences between the finite and the infinite. The finite is measurable. The infinite is immeasurable. In finitude, there is size, shape, differences, contrast, comparison, preference, separateness leading to conflicts, grasping this or that, to greed, hate, and violence with frustrated greed, fear and suspicion, etc., etc. In short, all the causes and conditions that give rise to and constitute dukkha, all that which denies and withers up love and freedom, wisdom and peace, harmony and order, beauty and bliss. But who is responsible for this finitude, this dukkha? I am responsible for it. It is this I, afflicted by avidya and tanha, which draws the boundaries, the artificial boundaries, between self and not self, pleasant and painful, acceptable and unacceptable, which is enslaved by preferential choice, and which is the arch sinner trying to break up the unity of the universe. I, the psychophysical organism, the existential being, am afflicted by avidya and tanha, partly, perhaps mainly, through the activity of the sense organs and brain. The senses and brain are pure mind constricted, pure consciousness befogged, darkened. Hence, the world is a magic show, a bubble, a lightning flash, the gleam of a firefly, an illusion. With the flash of awareness of infinity, the world as we know it through the senses and brain, of which we are aware vijnanically, vanishes, That is, the same old one world is all there, but we are conscious of it as one whole reality, not merely as countless bits and bobs. Put in other words, the confused unrelatedness of all the bits and bobs has given place to the ordered relatedness of unitary totality in our consciousness. This ordered relatedness of unitary totality is the meaning of the word Ritta, which occurs in the Rig Veda, of Asha in the Zarathustrian teachings, of Dhamma in its transcendental context in Buddhist terms. And also you'll find it in the yoga teachings. The Dharma is that which upholds. Its root is dhri, to uphold. What do you uphold? This ordered relatedness of the universe. We as we are intruders upon the harmony and peace of the cosmos. We are interferers with the living process of the totality. Because we have vijnana, discriminative consciousness, in Genesis it was presented as a choice. The power of choice was there. Shall I? Shan't I? Shall I take the apple? Shall I not eat the apple? It looked very nice, right? I'll eat it. And that's where all the rot started. Woman again. So we can understand why the holy ones of yesterday called the world unreal and advised their disciples to be rid of self-identification with the body, with nama-rupa, with all the different constituent elements making up nama-rupa. It was the genius of the Buddha that gave the best possible verbal formulation in and for those early days 25 centuries ago. Netam mama. This is not mine. Nezoham asmi. This am I not. Na me so atta. That is not the Atta, the Atman of me. That is, I believe, the exact translation. That is not the Atma of me. And he taught his disciples that in relation to the Rupa, the body, in relation to Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, and Vijnana. Not vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbatopavam. Vijnana, which is characterless, invisible therefore, endless, beginningless therefore, everywhere shining. You see the implications in that. The implications are the infinite and the eternal, and the completely self-replenishing, self-sustaining. So too, we have been talking about infinity, so too with eternity. We are ordinarily conscious in terms of what we call time, consisting of the past, the present, the future. The past is a memory phenomenon, a series of fixed pictures, static in fact, but moving and therefore changing as our memory decays, thereby falsifying those pictures continually. The future is an anticipation phenomenon. Desires, daydreams, hopes, expectations, fears, all causing anxiety now. Both past and future are terrible conditioners tormentors, debilitators, and confusion and illusion producers. We cling to them, and all clinging spells dukkha. If we desire nirvana, if we desire fulfillment, if we desire the transcendent, etc., that desire will undo whatever we try to do in order to realize our desire. You remember I said the other day, desire from desiderare, de, a turning away from, de is away from, and siderare, from sidus, sideris, a star, which is a self-shining light. This sabbato pabam, pabam, shining, self-shining light. You see, so all desire is a turning away from the self-shining light. No desire can ever truly represent that self-shining light. It will supervene if we cleanse the temple, which is the existential being. You will find in the Skanda and Maitreya Upanishads the statement, the body meaning the whole of the Nama Rupa, the whole psychophysical organism, the body is the temple. The dweller in the temple is Shiva. Our duty is to keep the temple clean, to cleanse the temple. Then Shiva shines there. Mind you, it's a tremendous teaching, really. So we cling to all these things, and all clinging spells dukkha. Away with them. So we are left with the present, the immediate now. And the immediate now is like the mathematical point, no length, no breadth, no depth. It is immeasurable. The immediate now belongs really to the transcendent context. For us individually, that immediate now can be long or short according as our power of attentiveness is strong or weak and our consciousness is sluggish or agile. You know, people who are really backward, who haven't grown up properly, their sensitivity is extremely slow. It's something like the dinosaur, you know. A mouse bites its tail, and 2 weeks later, the dinosaur tells his wife, "My dear, something tickled with the end of my tail. Will you look down and see who's there?" We are just that much sensitive to inner reality. I'm not being cynical or harsh. I think this is very, very true of most human beings. Duration is a succession, swift or slow, of many immediate nows, giving us the illusory impression of a fluid continuity. Our sense of time is as if it were a river. Isn't there a hymn, "Time like a river"?
Like an ever-flowing stream.
That's it. May we regard time as the rhythm of the living process of the universe. A rhythm is something very much alive. It's not a dead beat, 1, 2, 3, 4, just absolutely mechanical beat, a beat like that. Your heartbeat, the rhythm of the flow of your blood, the rhythm of your breathing especially, the rhythm of your of your conscious attention, when you are really giving your whole attention to something or other. We almost never give our whole attention to anything. If and when we can give our total attention to anything, then the self, that which obstructs transcendence, is no longer present. There is no center. So, we may regard time as the rhythm of the living process of the universe, a rhythm with innumerable variations. Many people identify timelessness with eternity, but timelessness is a human experience bounded by two instants in time. When you enter into the deep states of consciousness, and you may enter the deep states of consciousness not in the religious and the mystic sense, you can enter it as an ordinary enjoyer of life. When you are dancing with your beloved from 10 in the evening till 5 in the morning, you suddenly wake up and say, good gracious, where has all that time gone? You experienced timelessness, complete timelessness. But you see, the existential being, the nama rupa, enters into the timeless state at one instant in ordinary time, time by the clock. And when you emerge out of that state of timelessness, and you have to emerge out of it simply because the body has to be fed, it has to eliminate, it has to do so many things, you see, otherwise you'd die. So it is bounded by time. So timelessness actually, although it foreshadows eternity, is not eternity itself. I can't present eternity to you in words, at least up till now I have never succeeded in suggesting, in using words which are sufficiently suggestive, sufficiently alive to sort of stimulate you to wake up to something of the reality of eternity. So eternity completely subsumes both time and timelessness, and completely interpenetrates time and timelessness. But it remains the nameless unknown. That is why in the Upanishadic writings, you find the teachers and pupils talking about the videha mukti, the liberation without, minus the body, that means after the death of the existential being. That is assuming that there is that which survives. Well, that which survives is the eternal only, the indescribable eternal. Don't try to grasp at these things. Don't believe a word I say. Don't reject it out of hand. Just let be. Just let be, and you'll get a feel of things. Some sort of sensitivity may awaken. And if something really flashes, your whole world will undergo complete transformations, your whole world of mind and consciousness. We may well say, eternity rides on the wings of time and rests in the peace and tranquility of timelessness, and itself is the inconceivable and indescribable. It is more than all that, and also other than that. That more can never be touched consciously by any living human being. It is completely beyond the possibility of realization by any member of the human species, whether he be you or I or the worst person in the world or a Buddha. There are limitations imposed upon us by existentiality. We must realize that. Our friend Lucifer desired to grasp that. And the Almighty said, "Sorry, boy, go downstairs." This may help us to glimpse, although only dimly, the last part of the Hridaya Sutra, the Heart Sutra. During timelessness, time, duration, all our psychical states, change, growth, fulfillment, all of them completely vanish. There is just that pure consciousness which is the shining void, the vinyanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabam, the atta, the atman of the Upanishadic teachings by the perfected holy ones. In the profoundest samapattis, pure mind and enlightened consciousness, unobstructed by the constricting and darkening influences of nama and rupa, function freely through you, the living existent. When you do enter meditation, in meditation, do enter the real deep states, you are a source of tremendous spiritual energies emanating out of yourself. The creative and the primordial creative energy manifests throughout you. No one else sees it unless he himself is capable of that state. And when the old real spiritual teachers and their disciples sat together to meditate together and experience the immortal hour, as we may call it, what happened was a spiritual induction from teacher to pupil. When some of the bhikkhus fell ill, they requested the Buddha to come and see them, or Sariputta would come, etc. And how did their conversation end? So and so, we'll say John Smith for convenience, because we are in England. John Smith, is rupa permanent or impermanent? And he would say impermanent. He would answer impermanent. Is impermanence painful, sorrowful, or pleasant? You see, and so on. And then he ends up by, of course he says it's sorrowful, it's dukkha. And therefore, do not cling to it. Now, this was not, a tutorial, which was just a set of words from one fellow to another fellow. Not at all. The teacher was capable of being in that state of consciousness which conveyed a tremendous influence to the disciple. And the disciple's own consciousness was lifted into that condition. You know, there's a hint of this in the New Testament. And the manhood was lifted into the Godhead. It's this sort of thing that happens between teacher and pupil. In fact, there are no words spoken when the disciple is really at an advanced stage. The words come along afterwards in order to, express it for the benefit of ignorant people like myself. And that's that. In the profoundest samapattis, pure mind and enlightened consciousness, unobstructed by the constricting and darkening influences of nama and rupa, function freely through you, the living existent, when you come back to the vinyanic sphere. But you, the arahat, the Bhagavant, the perfected Holy One, the human come to full fruition, are no longer imprisoned by existentiality, although utilizing Nama and Rupa, as long as the Nama Rupa is alive. You have realized, made real, that means, realized, to realize means to make real. You have realized that form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Samsara is nirvana. Nirvana is samsara. If you were a Brahman, Aham Brahmasmi would be your lion's roar. If a son of God, I and the Father are one would be your lion's roar. If a Hindu after the days of the Gita, Pratyagatma and Paramatma are one. And this would be truth because isolative self-consciousness, that dark shadow born of avidya, that death-dealing separator from the infinite eternal, has been completely transmuted by transcendent light.